You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Tour de France, brought to you by iWoka, flexible loans built for small businesses. iWoka.co.uk. Today we're in Poitiers.
Where are we, Lionel?
Well, Richard, we are in Chauvigny, which is the start town of tomorrow's stage. We were supposed to be staying in Poitiers, the finish town of today's stage, but we took a look at our hotel for the night. We won't name the establishment.
Yeah, no names.
We won't name the establishment, but it didn't look
inviting.
I mean, we don't mind roughing it occasionally when needs must, but...
And we've landed on our feet, haven't we?
We have. Although you're not a fan of dogs in restaurants.
Well, we're actually outside a restaurant. We're in the terrace.
The dog doesn't like the local cat walking onto the terrace.
That's the problem. Yeah, two cats actually went to provoke the local dog, so you can.
It's sort of like Lucas Postelberger with Askreen and
Jungles,
two cats and a dog in the break.
I'm just picturing Lucas Postelberger as a scalded cat. Yeah. Arching his back and Well, we'll get onto that, won't we? But we should describe where we are, because it's this is the start town tomorrow, and I didn't know it, and it's beautiful. Been here before, Francois?
No, never. I heard about it because I had to write about it for the Tour de France tourist guide that you can find on the internet, actually, at the heritage pages of the official website. Well, it's a bit late in the tour to tell you that, but if you go to the official website and Sage is Boring, you can click on heritage and you know all about the little towns we're going through, and you'll find out that some of the comments you hear on television.
Well, I was going to say, yeah.
have been borrowed from somebody.
Well,
somebody
to be
else's
fair,
writings.
That is why you write the guide.
Well,
though,
that's
isn't it?
It's
for all the broadcasters and everyone working on
absolutely
the race. And yeah. Well, so Chauvigny is a little hilltop medieval town. There's a medieval fort behind us. A very attractive pale yellow stone, which is
twinned with Billericay and Essex,
which
really?
Is very similar.
Oh well. Billericay Dicky. I remember a song by Ian Dury. I'm not going to sing that.
Maybe at the end.
But no, it's very pleasant. And, well, we had three lovely nights in La Rochelle, didn't we? And haven't really updated listeners on my culinary exploits, but I think the golden knife and fork belongs to La Rochelle at the moment, because over a couple of days had a very, very nice starter, which was smoked mackerel with the little beetroot crisp. And a salad and a very fresh vinaigrette. And then last night's main course was, for me, the best of the tour so far. Grilled octopus on they called it a caviar of aubergine and coriander. And now I wouldn't, except in a curry, I wouldn't put aubergine and coriander together, but it went perfectly. And the octopus was very well cooked. And I think, Francois, you gave it a thumbs up as well.
Yeah, we had the same. And it's the thing about octopus, when it's not well cooked, it's kind of rubbery, but these were, it was melting, in the mouth. It was really, really sweet, and it was amazingly cooked and very, very delicate. I mean, no, really, really, I love octopus. I could eat creatures with tentacles all day, and it's one of the best tentacle I've ever eaten.
This time you introduced us to last year, Francois, but we had red wine with a light red wine with our seafood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a connoisseur, that offended me last year, but I've grown to like it.
Yeah, because some of the seafood you can get is kind of very meaty and tasty and a little bit sweet. And we actually last night we had two bottles of Morgon. Morgon is Beaujolais wine.
We had three bottles. We were part of an expanded group. We had dinner with a TV crew from America, who are making a sort of behind-the-scenes film with EF. If you enjoyed the Movistar Netflix series, then they're seeking to do something similar with EF, and it seems to be going quite well for them. Mm. It's obviously a very unusual year, so that in itself, I think, gives it some extra interest.
Yeah, so the Morgon was for Morgon connoisseur. I know there are a few wine connoisseurs in listening to the podcast. It was a Morgon by Marcel Lapierre, of course, the Rolls of the Morgon.
On with the stage, on with the cycling.
Indeed. Well, we're heading inland again, aren't we? It's quite a strange tour in that we've come all the way east to west from the the southern part of the Alps to the Pyrenees, and then the transfer up, and now the race goes back across.
Mm. As I said, it's like a U-bend.
It is a bit, yeah.
Yeah, and we'll be going back to Paris, so kind of zigzagging across France, actually.
But we came across the southern part of the Massif Central, and we're going back across the northern part, where the Massif Central is massive, as it's the clues in the name. Anyway, stage 11 from Châtelaillon Plage to Poitiers, 166.5 kilometres, and the first man to attack was Mathieu Ladagnou of Groupama FDJ. I've been on the attack, I think, every day since Thibaut Pinot tumbled out of the
Ladagnou or Ladagnous? Ladagnous.
I say Ladagnous, but yeah, I know there's a doubt there. I think it's Ladagnous.
Mathieu Ladagnous of Groupama FDJ, then. It was on the up the road on his own. A very powerful group did try to go across. It had Oliver Narsen, Stefan Kung, Jasper Stuyven, Tom van Asbluck, Michael Gogol and Lucas Postelberger.
The cycling podcast, Lucas Postelberger. Yeah, we'll be hearing from him later in this episode.
Yeah, they tried to go across, but the peloton didn't fancy letting a group that strong go across. And so they chased it down, leaving Ladagnous out on his own.
Mm. Dubbed Lada, because you know, some guys who are looking for nicknames, he's dubbed by his friends, teammates, Lada. But they say he's a Lada, but he's got a bigger engine. There you are.
Is there any conflict there with Skoda, who sponsored the Tour?
I'm sorry about that.
they used to be the rivals, didn't they, Lada and Skoda?
That's
Skoda
right.
Have really kind of...
They've zoomed off.
Zoomed ahead.
You know, and Lada, I think,
Skoda
very
right.
much.
Very nice car.
Very yes, much.
I think if Lada offer us a car, we might be on the phone to Skoda quite quickly.
But they're... I think the Larders are puttering along in front of the broom wagon, aren't they?
That's what you can say about Lada News. You know, his given name is Lada, but he rides like a Skoda, right?
Well, anyway. But that wasn't the last we heard of Postelberger or saw of Postelberger in the stage, because after Lada News had been caught 43 kilometres from the end, Postelberger went on the attack 7 kilometres from the finish. We'll find out a little bit about why he did that. He was then marked by Kasper Askren and Bob Jungels of De Koning Quickstep. So that was another really powerful group up the road. And they looked okay, but they clearly weren't going to stay away. Just at the bottom of the final hill, Askren pulled off and left Jungels and Postelberger to it. But they were caught pretty much 2 kilometres to go, bang on 2 kilometres to go. And then in the sprint, the first sort of eye-catching move was the B&B Hotels guys coming to the front, and a very strong lead out from Kevin Reiser looking for his sprinter Brian Cockard behind. Ryan Gibbons looked good as well, but perhaps went a bit too early. And then it was the big guns came to the front. Sam Bennett looking for his second stage win in a row, but he was beaten by Caleb Ewan, who won his 5th Tour de France stage, the second of this race after his victory in Sisteron. He was ahead of Sagan, who kind of double nudged Wout van Aert and was later disqualified for that move, irregular sprinting. So although it was Ewan, Sagan and Sam Bennett over the line, Bennett and van Aert moved up to 2nd and 3rd respectively. And that's had a significant impact on the green jersey, because Bennett is now well clear of Sagan, 68 points clear. But Richard, as you made the point, Sagan will probably finish the Tour without too much trouble.
I remember Marcel Kittel was nailed on to win the green jersey a few years ago, and then in the Alps he crashed and he pulled out, and Sagan, if nothing else, he will finish the Tour. And you know, that's what does for a lot of sprinters, isn't it? It's the mountains.
Yeah, but it's a blow to his chances, because I think Sam Bennett will, as all the sprinters, dreams to, you know, get to Paris to sprint and win the bunch sprint there. So, yeah, it's going to be more interesting than we thought in the first place.
No change overall. Primoz Roglic still in yellow, of course. Benoit Cosnefroy, who we've not really mentioned for a few days, is still in the polka dot jersey. That may change. Well, I'm not sure. Certainly by the weekend, that could change. And a couple of riders are out. Gregor Mühlberger, Postelberger's teammate in Bora Hansgrohe, has abandoned due to illness. We saw him on the TV screen not looking the best, and he pulled out of the race. And Jon Izagirre of Astana is out, having crashed with 29 kilometres to go. So Astana are down a mountain man.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalka. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalka. If you run a small business, find out more at iwalka.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
thank you very much indeed to Iwoka for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. They are a title sponsor, have been since March, and if you run a small business and you want to find out what Iwoka might be able to offer you, go to iwoka.co.uk. Lionel, you mentioned Lucas Postelberger, and unfortunately Gregor Mühlberger had a bad day, and we've just ordered burgers.
We have, goat cheeseburgers.
Yeah. So it's a burger kind of day. I mean, we're going to hear from Lucas Postelberger. We saw him in a very strong breakaway, and then he attacked about 5 kilometers ago. You know, they're the two kind of teams that are going for the green jersey, Bora Hansgrohe and De Koenig Quickstep, and he was marked by Bob Jungels and Casper Askren, which was sort of calling his bluff a little bit. I was very surprised to see that move, though, and it was strong enough that you wondered whether... You look back, and you know, without De Koenig Quickstep or Bora Hansgrohe leading the bunch, who was going to bring them back? I mean, they were brought back, but those were three very strong riders to be away.
Yeah, I thought it was quite clever tactics, really, because having, Bora Hansgrohe and De Koenig Quickstep putting riders up the road took the pressure off them completely on the last 7 or 8 kilometre run-in, and that meant that they wouldn't have to do any chasing at all, and perhaps, certainly in the case of De Koenig Quickstep, maybe their legs were stinging a little bit after yesterday because they did a lot of work to control and put Sam Bennett into position, particularly Michael Moorcock. So it sort of made sense because it was win-win, really. There was a lot of firepower there. If Askelin or Jungels had won that stage, you wouldn't have been surprised, would you?
Yeah, but win-win for who? I mean, there was a moment, and I don't know what was going through their minds because, I mean, the options were open. Did they go to catch Postelberger and bring him back into the bunch, and which looked like the thing they were like watchdogs for Sam Bennett? But after a while they took their turns, and you had the impression they were ready to go for it if all of a sudden a gap had emerged. But in the end, you can't help thinking that with, as you say, with the big effort they did yesterday and this that little extra effort, knowing that Askren is kind of the first, the first carriage in the cunning quick step train, then maybe there was something missing in the finale. And look, we can discuss the disqualification, and we will do that. But in the end, Bennett was actually only third on the line behind Caleb Ewan and Sagan, and so maybe the clever move was the move by Postelberger, because that's what he was planning to do.
Shall we hear from him what was in his mind, and also some reaction to his teammate Peter Sagan being disqualified?
Hi guys, thanks for watching and cheering. Yeah, the mission was to make a hard final or create a hard final to put the sprinter teams under pressure. It usually fits Peter also better when there is a little bit more tension in the muscles and legs and everybody, because he's resisting a bit better, I would say. So I had a go and eventually taking the stage win, or at least making it hard. And I felt quite good, actually. In the beginning, we created already a group with, I would say, some friends on the road. We did this already last year and 2 years ago. Yeah, it's a kind of annual event. It was quite fun. Gregor, he went really deep in the last Pyrenees stage. He pushed himself way over the limit, I would say, and he was still recovering from that, but he feels really empty and not good at all and not capable to continue racing. So he decided to go out and focus on the next races. He's really tired and needs to recharge the batteries. Pretty tough decision, actually. So we keep fighting. The tour is not over yet. It's like 10 days to go. A lot of points on the road. And the race is over in Paris, usually. I mean, now you never know who can be over every day, but the spirit is good and the mood. Yeah, we are still committed and we try to fight for green.
So that was Lucas Postelberger, who's one of the riders keeping an audio diary for us at the Tour de France. And yeah, really interesting to hear that it was a deliberate plan to just shake things up a bit in the sprint and make it a bit edgy, and I think make it more of a fight. I think Sagan enjoys that. maybe too much at times. I mean, obviously they feel that the disqualification was harsh. It was a relegation rather than disqualification, of course, I should say. I mean, some people have said that Sagan was avoiding selfie sticks that were in his way. I'm not sure about that. I think that he was manoeuvring Wout van Aert out of the way. I mean, first of all, I was very surprised to see Wout van Aert sprinting. That's one thing to say. But Sagan, we've seen him do it before. It is dangerous. And, you know, he was coming up the inside of the barriers. But, you know, in sprinting, if you're Pascal Ackermann and you get through a gap like that, you're a hero. And if you create danger or crash, then you've messed it up. The margins are very, very slim.
Laurent Jalabert on French TV, who used to be a sprinter before, you know, before becoming an all-rounder in his old days, in his older days, found that, and maybe in his time, he was considered perfectly normal. But what he was saying is that if he didn't try to budge a little bit to the left, he would have been too close to the barriers and was risking crashing. So in the eyes of Jalabert, Sagan was actually more trying to avoid crashing, you know, going too far right and crashing than really upsetting Wout van Aert. But, you know, it's always disputable, these sort of things. My take on these you know, sprint finishes is we discuss, and we can discuss many times, was it violent, was it dangerous, was it legal, was it irregular. There are guys whose job it is to judge that, who know more about cycling and sprint finishes than we do, and these guys are commissaire for the UCI. So if he was relegated, it's probably right.
Or indeed the riders.
But, I mean, a nudge with the head is not
allowed. Yeah, we saw Mark Renshaw disqualified for that, didn't we?
That was a head butt. You described that as a butt.
I think it was a head butt. I think if you use a head, it's a head butt.
Yeah, but I mean, he made contact as well, didn't he?
We have to speak to our friends in Glasgow to get the actual definition.
But you can't make an aggressive move with the head in a sprint.
No.
So it's open and shut case.
And a lesser bike handler than Wout van Aert might have struggled with that. Because once you're that close, I mean, all four of them were very close as they crossed the line. Caleb Ewan, Sam Bennett, Wout van Aert, Peter Sagan. It was a great finish, you know.
Well, you could throw a napkin over them on the line.
But you
can always ask, how aggressive was the nudge, you know? Was it trying to keep his balance and then his head moved towards...
If there isn't space to go, then you don't go, you know?
You do if you're Pascal Ackermann and you win.
You do. Yeah, exactly.
You're referring to the Tirreno-Adriatico sprint from a couple of days ago.
And yeah. Fabio Jakobsen at the Tour of Poland... A few weeks ago now, you know, he went up a similar gap. Dylan Groenewegen squeezed it a bit and you know, caused him to crash, not deliberately, but he caused him to crash and hurt himself really, really badly. You know, Primoz Roglic in his post-race interview in the press conference said that sprinters are crazy. He agreed with Sagan's relegation, but sprinters are crazy and they will take risks, and when they see the line in front of them, they will do whatever it takes to try and get there first.
It's interesting, Francois, mentioning Laurent Jalabert talking on French television, because and you mentioned when he was a bunch sprinter before he became an all-rounder, and one of the things that sort of made that transition to an all-rounder was an absolutely horrendous crash in Armentier, where he crashed into a policeman standing inside the barriers.
Taking a photograph.
Yeah, and it just made me think of a kind of chain of how the sprints have evolved and how every kind of few years something else becomes obviously dangerous. That was a point where clearly, let's not have people standing in the road. That's ridiculous. Then we talked in our series for Friends of the Podcast, My First Tour, about the big corrugated plastic PMU promotional hands that were given out to the spectators in 2006, one of which cut Tour Hushovd on the arm in Strasbourg, and then they replaced those with kind of papery ones to make them safer. And today we have the selfie stick situation. Now, it seems to me pretty obvious that if you're watching the finish of a Tour de France stage, even with slightly reduced crowds, don't hold a selfie stick over the riders in the road. I mean, whether or not that had any bearing on where Sagan was moving.
Do you want a neat little link back to today's stage winner from Armentier? Wilfred Nelson came off worst in that crash. Mm. His teammate was Marc Sargeant, who about 25, 30 kilometres from the finish had gone back to the team car to get Nelson a helmet, which wasn't compulsory at the time. Went back to get him a helmet. He wore it, and it might have saved his life. Who knows? He was very, very badly injured. Today, Marc Sargeant is Caleb Ewan, team boss at Lotto Soudal.
Brought it full circle. But you're right, the sprints are dangerous. The riders are crazy. The red mist descends in a sort of semi-controlled way. And, I mean, we've seen Sagan involved in incidents before. He's a fantastic bike handler, but I think sometimes he makes the assumption that everyone around him is as competent and capable when it comes to staying upright. And well, 9 times out of 10 they are. And but you just can't move your head at another rider in the sprint finish.
And also when you really led your sprint the right way and are sprinting to the line in commanding fashion most of the time, you're very rarely on the left hand side or the right hand side. It happens, of course, but most of the time you're straight in the middle because you're the most powerful, like Sam Bennett yesterday or Caleb Ewan today. They were in no trouble because they kept their line, they found the opening, and they were more powerful. And when you attempt the sort of things, you know, Pascal Ackermann, we mentioned in Tirreno Adriatico, attempted to do, that's very, very, very risky. And once again, and Sagan seems to like to try and dodge around the others and attack from the wings, I should say. And it's a risky move.
I have to say, though, that Sagan, you know, people write him off. His consistency is amazing. And actually, I thought today he looked good. You know, he looked fast. And that move by Postelberger maybe did help him in the finish. Yeah.
But we've got to have a word for Caleb Ewan, the stage winner. I mean, 3 stage wins last year, 2 today. That would be impressive. 2 this year. Richard, you made the point after listening to his press conference afterwards. He's just so nice. I mean, he doesn't look like somebody who has the killer instinct of a bunch sprinter.
We kind of think of sprinters being very alpha and, you know, testosterone fueled and maybe quite aggressive and sometimes abrasive. And we've seen a few of them over the last few years, although Marcel Kittel wasn't like that either. But, you know, the great rivalry of the 90s was Cipollini, Abdujaparov, and Caleb Ewan and Sam Bennett are not that. You know, they're good friends. David Walsh asked Caleb Ewan afterwards about their friendship and said, I believe you live in the same apartment. Caleb Ewan corrected him on that. He said, we don't live in the same apartment. We live in the same apartment block in Monaco. But they're great friends. And it's, you know, it's nice. I mean, I'm not complaining about this, but there isn't that edge to their rivalry. Yeah.
Who's coming out of the lift first, you know?
Well, if they did live in the same apartment, I mean, you know, they take turns going to the kitchen to get a beer when watching the television side by side on the sofa. It's quite a nice image. I mean, it would make a little sitcom.
Yeah, it's not true, though, Lionel.
And what's interesting as well is that you can't think of more different, in terms of mentally they're very close, but physically they're two very distinct style of sprinters, and the sprinters we like. I mean, Bennett is more powerful and power. Well, mind you, he was when he was younger, when he started with Bora, skinnier and more the Cavendish and Ewan type, but Ewan is more the crisp, fast.
I mean, the comparisons are obvious. He's Australian, rides for Lotto Soudal. He's Robin McEwen for the 21st century, isn't he, really?
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Our Tour de France coverage is sponsored by the next generation Watt bike Atom. Lionel, you've been testing out again, putting it through its paces this year. And a few days ago, you talked about the way that it hooks up to various apps. But what about the design of the Watt bike? Has that changed much?
Well, at first glance, it looks pretty much identical to the previous Atom, but there are a few little tweaks if you look carefully, mainly to make adjusting the position easier than it was before. The seat post now is designed to make it even easier to put up and down, because I think Watt Bike have realised that a lot of people may be sharing their Watt Bike with a partner or family member, and making the position even easier to change is something that saves time when you're trying to squeeze a session in. One big advantage that's obvious to me is that you're not riding your own bike on a turbo trainer, and so there's no setup time between rides. You're not taking the bike in and out, putting the wheel in and out, so it saves you a lot of time, and you're not putting wear on your own bike riding it indoors as well as out, which is something that I must admit does appeal to me. The Watt bike looks pretty cool, doesn't it? It's won a prestigious IF design award, which is presented by a world-renowned design magazine, but I think great design is not just about how something looks, it's a combination of form and function. And when you look at the Watt bike, You can tell there's nothing on it that doesn't need to be there. You know, the red rubber seals that keep all the sweat out are really important little finishes, but they look good too. We know that indoor riding can be a sweaty business. There's no little nooks and crannies for the moisture to gravitate towards. And so they've really thought about how the piece of equipment is going to be used when coming up with the design, I think. And it's compact as well. I mean, my home performance center is not the biggest room in the world, but it tucked away in the corner neatly. It's no bigger than it needs to be.
Well, it doesn't need to be very big, does it, Lionel? Let's face it. But the Wattbike Atom, if you'd like to own one of these beautiful machines that's been gracing Lionel's high performance lab, it's available now from £90 per month. Go to wattbike.com. That's wattbike.com. Well, this was the second of the double header of sprint stages that we were talking about in our episode of Kilometer Zero that came out on Wednesday now, isn't it? Time's flying. Kilometer Zero, supported by Zwift, powered by Zwift. Very grateful to them for their support of that series, Monday to Friday mornings. And we decided with these two sprint stages to really look at Sam Bennett, not just because he's not won a stage of the Tour de France until yesterday, but also because he is De Koenig Quickstep's number one sprinter, and that's become the sort of prime sprinting slot in cycling. You know, if you're their number one sprinter, then a lot is expected of you and there's a lot of pressure on you. I spoke to him on the rest day about that. He's always a very honest guy. He spoke about how the pressure was real, and you know, he was looking at these two stages as really important opportunities. He took it in Ile de Ré. He won the stage there. So we got a reaction from Michael Morkov, his lead out man, and that's in today's Kilometer Zero. That's Wednesday's Kilometer Zero. There's also a great sort of breakdown of the sprint by Mitch Docker, who studied it, watched it really closely, and really told us what went on.
Speaking of Mitch Docker, his latest Life in the Peloton episode is also out. He's done a kind of Tour de France post bag answering questions from his listeners. There's some cracking questions and some really great answers in that. If you've not listened to Life in the Peloton with Mitch Docker of EF Pro Cycling, it's on our podcast feed now. Richard, you mentioned about Sam Bennett winning yesterday and getting his first stage win the first stage win for Carrick-on-Shore since 1982. When Sean Kelly won in Po, and when we were in Po a few mornings ago, there's that road, the steep up, well, it's not that steep, but it's an uphill road that the race always goes out on, and they've painted on the road all the stage winners in Po, and there's Kelly there, 1982.
I guess Martin Early would be there as well. He won in Po as well.
I guess so, yeah, 1989, yeah. But the thing, what surprised me was the finish in Poitiers tonight. I suspect if Bennett hadn't won yesterday, he probably would have won today. I don't know.
Really?
Well, I don't know. I'm speculating.
I watched that and thought it's just as well he did win yesterday. Because I think Caleb Ewan is the quickest of the sprinters here. He doesn't have the team support. You know, they're quite reduced in numbers, but he's got that jump. Even Sam Bennett did very well today without Morkov as his lead-out man. They got lost. I think, as Francois said earlier, the late burst by Askren and Jungels probably messed up the De Koenig Quickstep train, which, again, you know, from that point of view, it was a good move by Postelberger, and this was probably the best we've seen of Sagan.
We need to mention here Kluger, I mean, as the lead-out man of Caleb Ewan, because Ewan said it, he actually took a kind of 6 or 7 k's turn, actually, to bring Ewan back to the front. There are only 5 Lotto Soudal riders left in the Tour de France, and still they managed to position their sprinter, well, in this case, better than bigger outfits like Duncan and Quickstep. So well, I think Roger Kluger really deserves a mention today.
They could have a good day tomorrow as well, couldn't they? Because we expect a breakaway tomorrow. Thomas de Gendt, I imagine, has his eyes on that stage.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science of Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. Is it appropriate to do the Science of Sport bit at precisely the moment when the wine arrives at the table? I'm not sure.
I think duck and butter gels is fine, but I'm not sure why.
Well,
in
the
work.
Old days, the tour doctor was called Gérard Porte, and he stayed the tour doctor for more than two decades. And he used to say there are only two medicines that work. Aspirin and red wine. So, I mean, one of it is coming our way.
We'll be extremely healthy by the end of this Tour de France. So, if you would like 25% off your science and sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code Francois. Just as he's about to say,
SISCP25.
SISCP25.
I got it this time.
Oh, well done. Well done. SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. And thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport, who are producing their duck and butter gels as we speak. That's right. And they'll be shipped out to France for Lionel.
I don't know what you were referring to.
No, we're going to in the final part of tonight's podcast, we're going to do something completely different. What do Josip Skoblar, Roger Magnussen, Chris Waddle, Kevin Keegan, Kenny Dalglish, Henny Kuiper, Greg LeMond, Roger Federer, Steve Ovett, Seb Coe, and Bodie Miller have in common? I think you know the answer.
Yeah,
to this,
I know the answer.
These are your sporting heroes, Francois.
Yeah, they are. They are actually. I mentioned in a post on Facebook a couple of weeks ago that these sports people are as inspirations of my youth as a sports lover, and well, some of them are kind of obvious. Josip Skoblar, you might never have heard of him. He was a Croatian football player playing for Marseille and scored 51 goals one season. Roger Magnussen was a Swedish player also playing for Olympique Marseille, which is my favorite club, obviously, and he was very, very gifted and fun. Kevin Keegan is there. Kenny Dalglish, because how could I say? Liverpool is, I mean, I may make enemies there, but it's my favorite, outside of France, is probably the club I support most.
The only thing that stuns me there is Coe and Ovett. I mean,
both of them.
In Britain, you had to choose.
Yeah, I know, but I couldn't choose. I couldn't choose because I was more of an 800 meters runner, and Seb Coe, whatever you think of him, was the most, was a genius of that distance. You know, you can't, I mean, is probably not the first, but a guy who can run the second 400, faster than the second 400 faster than the first. I mean, it was just absolutely amazing. He was made to run the 800, and Ovett was more interesting as a character, and it probably the better 1500, right? But both of them, the rivalry between them, it's like 20, 30 years. We always speak of Federer and Nadal and all those rivalries, and you have to include all these guys together. And now Henny Kuiper, it was a bit of a surprise.
Well,
is he the only cyclist on the list of Francois?
Greg LeMond is
Greg
the
LeMond. Oh, Greg LeMond. Okay. I mean, that was the whole point of bringing it up, so that took us on a bit of a tangent there. But, we were contacted a while ago by Bjorn Kuiper, Henny Kuiper's son, and he's done a lovely thing. And I spoke to him about being the son of a cycling legend. He helped produce a glorious big book with lots of photographs about his father's career in Dutch. They're trying to publish the book in English, and they've launched a crowdfunder appeal. The details of that in our show notes, so and we'll put them on social media as well. So if you want to support the publication of the book in English, then please do so. But he got in touch, and he put us in touch with Henny Kuiper. And I must admit, Henny Kuiper is a rider who I just missed because I got into cycling in the mid-80s as he was coming towards the end of his career. But Francois, why was he in your list of favourite sports people?
I love the look of him. You know, he was. I had a kind of anti-French bias at the time, as odd as it may seem. As a teenager, I was always going maybe for the foreign rider or sportsman, and Henny Kuiper was actually battling it out with Bernard Thévenet for in the late 70s, and then he still went on with his career when Eno came about, and I was battling against Eno, and I've always struggled with the two Bernards. You know, I didn't like Thévenet very much. He's a great guy, and you know, he's obviously a champion. But Kuiper was kind of the guy who was challenging this man, did never getting the credit. When you look at his record, it's amazing. Won Paris-Roubaix, won Milan San Remo, won the Worlds, won two stages of L'Alpe d'Huez, won, I mean,
twice second at the Tour de France.
Twice second at the Tour de France, came second in Liège, you know, the year when Eno won it in the snow. I mean, his palmarès, as we say, is just absolutely amazing. And yet he's not rated as high as Joep Zoetemelk or other, or Luis Ocaña, who are legends of the same time. And I love the fact that he's a real all-rounder. You know, there are not that many people who won in L'Alpe d'Huez and won in Paris-Roubaix. I think there's only Yannick Kuiper and Fausto Coppi. You know, I love this. He's very old-school rider. He's, you know, son of a farmer, like you know, never giving up. And there was also the kind of glamour of the TI Rally team as well that at the time really struck me when I was a kid. You know, these outfits. They invented a new form of cycling. So I think cycling became kind of modern for the first time with the TI Rally team. You know, it was all these put together meant, you know, Kuiper was an important figure to me.
And he won the Milk Race in 1972, so, you know.
He was also the Olympic road race champion.
And if you ride up Alpe d'Huez, you know that the 21 Bens have all got a sign on the corner with the name of the stage winners over the years, and Henny Kuiper's Bens are number 19 and 18 because he won back-to-back years, as you say, 1978 and 77 and 78.
And contributed to Alpe d'Huez becoming the Dutch mountain.
Absolutely. Well, Zoetemelk, Kuiper, Zoetemelk again, winning twice, you know, in the first, when Alpe d'Huez returned to the Tour after its first visit in 52, when it came a regular visit on the Tour from 1976 onwards, the Dutch dominated. And so that's why we have Dutch Corner today.
Well, thanks to Bjorn, I was put in touch with his father, Henny, and spoke to him just before I left to come to the Tour de France, so we thought we'd hear from him tonight.
In 75, I was world champion in the road race in Belgium. It was crazy. And then I went for the Tour de France, and a few years later, in the TR Rally team, I missed, for 48 seconds, I missed the yellow jersey in Paris. So,
what do you remember of your first Tour de France, 1975? You were 11th there. What did you make of your first Tour de France?
The survival of the fitness, actually, for me. It was totally new, and it was such a great event when you do races by the amateurs. Yeah, I was in Bulgaria, in Yugoslavia, in Milk Race and the Tour of Holland.
And in those years, you were riding for TI Rally. I mean, I want to ask you about TI Rally, and I want to ask you about Alpe d'Huez as well. TI Rally, the team Peter Post, that team is a sort of legendary team in cycling. Yeah. Did it feel like that to be part of it? I mean, what was it like to be part of that team?
We had Jan Raas. I think he was a classic man, but Jan was also a big leader. Peter Post was the organizer, the sport director, who were organizing the team very well, because in that day, for instance, the Belgian teams, they were not, they had many, many riders in the team. And then still on, also the marketing in the sport came. So Post had a very good nose for that. And with TR Rally, he has a big company. They had a good budget for that. In that time, we had very good riders in Holland. You see that now in England, when you have good riders, everybody won't be a new room or however, and give some a big boost on the sport. And Peter Post, he was, what I told you, a good organizer, and the good riders were all coming, because there was not another team in the beginning, came to him, and that was, the result was, we won, I think, 2 years in a row, 10 or 12 stages, I thought.
I've read sort of comparisons with, you know, Dutch football, the sort of total football idea. It was like total cycling, where you had this very strong team and riders who could win on their own, but perhaps willing to help their teammates win as well. Was that a very new way of organizing a team? And did that all come from Post?
That's right. Because normally you had Felice Gimondi as his own team, and for sure in Italy, you have always a leader of a team. It was forbidden to pass the top rider in the race. You were also in the finish line. You stay behind him. Otherwise, you could look for another team next year. Eddy Merckx has, he was the leader of Molteni, but Post, he had a new tactic, everybody for one and one for everybody, you know? And that works very well. Richard, you need good riders too. And in that moment, we had a lot of good riders in Holland.
After that 77 Tour de France, how did you feel having gone so close to winning it? Were you disappointed? Did you have regrets? Or did you reflect on, you know, finishing on the podium and the achievement of that?
That is a good question, because in that time I thought, oh, say I was 28 years old, my time is coming, you know. I was a good now second. I kind of win and I want to win because the Tour de France was my race. I love it. But then time is flying by. Eh? And the year later, I won Alpe d'Huez again, but then I broke my collarbone. Then I went to Piso in 79. I came 14th overall. It was not my best Tour de France. And then 80, Joop Zoetemelk, that's right, I won. I was second. And I'm still on, your time is over, you know, to win it. Because it's not so easy to win the Tour de France. I had my chance, but I didn't win. But Richard, you know, I am a guy, when I go for it, I go for it. I give all my energy then, you know, and to make it in the Tour, after several years, the motivation was still, but the morale was maybe a little broken, and I had an idea. You know, one day on a mountain stage, I came to the finish line, and it was special. People go home already. And then I lost 50 minutes, and that was so hard for me in my head to accept that. And then still on, you losing the idea that you can win a Tour de France. And then my friend, José de Kouwer, who is now a TV commentator, he was my best friend, and we always worked together. And he said, what you should do, put it out of your head, the Tour de France. Go for the classics, you can do that also. And then I concentrate me more on the classics, and that is also nice in the book, all those stories. I start to do that. You said also that Fausto Coppi, he won the etappe on Alpe d'Huez in the Tour de France, and he won Paris-Roubaix. So
yeah, you're in good company there. Yeah, yeah.
I did it. And when you're in the race by yourself, you're professional, you don't even realize what you're doing such a great things. But then later on, when you come older, and now when the book is there, it's unbelievable what happened in my life.
I mean, what's your favorite victory of your career?
That was Paris-Roubaix. The race I have my nicest memory is the Olympics, because you are young, you have a dream, and you go to the Olympics and you come back with a gold medal. That was for me very, very special. I when I was young, I couldn't even dream that I could win that, and I did it, you know. But then you came professional, you do the Tour de France, you do all kind of races. Paris-Roubaix was the race. I'm son of a farmer. I'm a worker. You have to be working hard to have good results in cycling. But Paris-Roubaix, over the cobblestones, when you have a flat tire, you can still win the race and you have to again come back. And so in the 83 on the 10th of April, yeah, it was such a day. I was unbeatable. And yeah, I won that race. It was really great.
That was Henny Kuiper. Henny Kuiper seems to be the correct pronunciation, which I think you're nailing there, Francois. It was nice to hear from one of your sporting heroes.
Oh, yeah, because a few years back, we're in the same hotel in Toulouse, and I went down for breakfast, and he was there, and I thought, am I going to talk to him and tell him, Henny, you're my, you know, teenage idol or so? And I kind of dared not, you know. I'm not emotional in front of riders generally, but, you know, your teenage idols are different. So I just didn't go. And
well, tomorrow night we've got Kenny Dalglish. And for the rest of the tour, we're going to work through one of your sporting idols every night.
Well, we could, Steve Ovett, we could have Freddie Ovett on. And you
we could
maybe
get Freddie Ovett on, yeah. 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 Anyway, we should wrap things up for tonight. A bit different tonight with the Henny Kuiper. But as I said, if you want to support the crowdfunding appeal to publish the book in English with all these glorious photographs, see our show notes. We'll put the link on social media as well. What are we expecting tomorrow? A breakaway, chaps?
I think certainly a breakaway tomorrow.
Yes,
we
head towards the middle of France, the very middle.
Peter Sagan obviously will go for to try and reconquer the green jersey, so it might be in an early break. And then, yeah, the Thomas de Gendt and Greg Van Avermaet.
Van Avermaet. Van Avermaet.
On that bum note.
Thanks, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Francois. Thanks.